Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Justin DeClue, who co-hosts The Important Cinema Club with Will Sloan, co-hosts No Such Thing as a Bad Movie with Colin Cunningham and April Litmanski, and co-hosts Loose Cannons with Matthew Kumar. Those are podcasts. They're really good. He's also a filmmaker, having written and directed the short film We're in a Fight and the feature Teddy Bomb. His second feature, Impossible Horror, premiered at the Toronto After Dark Festival last year, screened at Lincoln Center in New York earlier this summer, and now celebrates its arrival on Blu-ray with a release party and theatrical screening this coming Tuesday, October 23rd, at 7:30 p.m. at the Royal in Toronto. Justin chose Army of Darkness, the capper to Sam Raimi's Evil Dead trilogy that finds Bruce Campbell's heroic Ash battling hordes of deadites at a castle somewhere in the 13th century, because that's just how his luck played out in the last movie. It's the comic culmination of a series of films that started out pretty seriously, and as a result, it was received with a sort of a shrug by audiences hoping for more straight-up zombie mayhem. In subsequent years, though, it's been accepted and embraced on its own terms. You either love it or you don't, and Justin does. This is Someone Else's Movie.
When I knew I was going to come onto this podcast, I was like, okay, I should pick a movie that, like, means something very important to me. And my first reaction was actually like, ooh, I should take something that is a little bit out there, like maybe something like Cemetery Man. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Mikhail Soloviev.
I saw that Midnight Madness, thank you.
Yeah, I love Cemetery Man. But then I was like, but if I had to pick one movie that I want to talk about and it means, like, a lot to me, I think Army of Darkness is the one at the top of my list. And the reason for that is it's probably the movie that, when I saw it, it just captured my imagination in a way that other movies haven't. And I know specifically, like, when I saw it, saw a clip on TV, and it was the stop motion skeletons. And at the time, I had just moved to a small town from Ottawa with my family, my mother specifically, to a French small town. And I didn't really have any friends, and, like, I wasn't a movie buff or anything like that. Movies were always something that, like, almost scared me. Like, when I would go to the theater, I would get very nervous, and I don't know why. Almost as if, like, what if it's not good? Like, okay. How will my family react? And then,
so you're concerned for their experience, not so much yours.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Like, that's what made me nervous. Because if I didn't like it, it wouldn't really bother me.
Did you pick the movie? Like,
no, I would never pick the movie.
Is this a situation where you're in charge and you have to provide everyone with a good time?
I don't think so.
Cause, I understand, like, that anxiety.
Yeah, because I think that, like, movies, especially going to the theater, were something very rare for me as a kid. Okay. Like, I can count on maybe, like, two hands the times that we actually went out and saw a movie. And it's just because my parents, they were separated. So, like, my mom, she worked really late. We were always at a babysitter. And my dad, we'd see him once a week and every two weekends. So going to the movies was something that was, like, very special. So I think that's probably why I felt really nervous. And this actually ties into Army of Darkness, but when I was in elementary school, growing up in Ottawa, my friend was the horror movie guy. Okay. Like, he knew everything. He had all, and this is hilarious to say, the Critters movies, the Leprechaun movies. He was obsessed with Predator and Aliens. I was not allowed to see these. So there was, like, a fascination as a kid of, like, I would go to his house and he'd have all these action figures, all these VHS tapes up, and I'd be like, oh my God, like, this looks so cool. So I think that there was, like, an obsession with kind of, like, horror and horror movies at that point, but I couldn't watch them. So there was no, like, I wouldn't call myself a movie buff by any stretch of the imagination. So back to, like, seeing Armor of Darkness on TV, it was in French. Yeah. I just saw a clip and I recorded the end of it, but I didn't know what the movie was. And that friend, who was obsessed with horror movies, he visited me in the small town the next day. And it was the last time I would ever see him until I would be in my 20s. Because, you know, you grow apart. Like, sure. you don't hang out anymore. I live an hour away.
Especially if you're not, you're a kid. Yeah, you can't control your own destination.
Yeah, there's no, like, transportation or anything like that. And I told him about this movie, and I'm like, I don't know what it is. And he knew instantly. He's like, oh, that's Army of Darkness. I was like, Army of Darkness? Well, I got to see the rest of this. And I don't remember how I saw the whole movie, but I did. And it just kind of, like, blew my brain in a way. And I think it was because, you know, I'm a young guy, and this idea of a movie showing me, like, it's directed. Like, no movie had connected with me in that way before.
Right.
Like, you know, Spielberg, I love Jurassic Park and all this stuff. But, like, Army of Darkness has a almost like a distancing effect in like you're watching a movie and this is all almost like mythological in the way that it's presented.
Yeah. Well, so much of Raimi's early films feel handmade mm-hmm. that way, right? Even, you know, you're watching process shots, you're watching elaborate special effects that he paid for and
yeah.
had, you know, brought to him, but they feel like he feels like he's right behind you going, look, 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 this is so cool.
Exactly. Like, he feels, like, energized about what he's doing. Even Army of Darkness, if you look into it, it was actually, like, a pretty big budget production.
Yeah, it was still, like, what was it, 12 or 13 million?
Something like that,
it
yeah.
Was, they were, it was big for the Evil Dead film.
And they were really, like, banking that it was gonna, like, be a huge hit, and then it was slapped with an R rating, and they were like, what the heck, and they couldn't do anything to get rid of that. Yeah. Which is funny that it played on TV all the time, because it's not an R-rated movie, like, it's PG-13 at the most.
Yeah, it's pretty innocuous. I think there's, like, the biggest... What's the most, like, the most violent thing in it is the stuff at the beginning.
There's some blood shoots up in the air, and there's actually some nudity.
Oh, that's right.
When there's, like, a shot of, like, skeletons walking by, and they have a bunch of women, and they're pulling on them.
Yeah.
And I think it looks like the woman was supposed to just, like, her hair cover her breasts, but it doesn't, and you see nipples, so I think that may be led to...
The De Laurentiis touch.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the first two are not... I mean, to put it in context, before I even do that, I want to get back and ask you, when was this? Was this 93 when it actually opened? Was it later?
No, it was much, much later. I would probably say, I had just moved, so I think I was probably 11 or 12 when I saw it on television.
Which puts you...
I was born in 87, so... Okay,
so the internet's around.
It is.
In the earliest stages.
Yeah, in the earlier stages.
I'm just fascinated by the idea that even then someone could see something
mm-hmm.
and have it haunt them and not have a way to clarify. But I guess if you look up skeletons fighting, you'll find Harryhausen.
Yeah, but I don't even think that was like my first instinct to like go on the internet and be like stop motion skeletons, trying to figure out what right. it was.
And this is only the course of a day.
Yeah, and like because it was the next day, and the film was just kind of like. And I remember I saw it and like taped it, and it was only the end of the movie because it's the skeleton part. And it was my friend told me what it was. I must have.
Oh, so the movie was on cable.
It was on cable. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm just trying to like you can't in my head you'd come across a clip or something.
No, it was like on. It was that playing, makes more sense. And it was in French too. So it wasn't even like right. Bruce Campbell's like voice that I was getting or getting any of the one liners. It was just this image, and I remember exactly the one was the skeletons crossing the bridge, mm-hmm. and it was like something that I had never really seen before. And like as I was growing up, like horror imagery was always something that like I was really attracted to, whether it be in like the Beetlejuice cartoon, I didn't see the movie until way later, or Simpsons Halloween specials, or even Goosebump books, which were like an obsession.
Sure,
but my mom did not allow me to like consume these things.
What was the objection? Was she afraid of nightmares? Did they give you nightmares?
I mean, I don't really recall having nightmares or being like scared like that. I think it was maybe just like a defense mechanism that she's like, I don't want him consuming these things that I perceive to be bad. Like yeah. I very specifically remember them taking me aside and going, you can't watch Beetlejuice the cartoon anymore. And I was like, what? Why can't I watch Beetlejuice? Like, it plays on Saturday morning. And it was just something about the horror imagery, I guess, that just kind of rubbed her the wrong way.
But kids love that stuff.
I know.
I think parents, I mean, I know this, parents grow up and don't understand that children don't see horror imagery the same way adults do.
I don't think she grew up that way. I don't think that was like a part of her life, and it's something she never really liked. So to see her kids kind of consume it confused her, I guess, and she was afraid that it would like go down a dark path.
Yeah,
which is weird because like TV was very regimented for a while, and then books were not. So like Goosebumps, I could just like eat those up, and they had scary covers too. But she would buy them for me. She got me costumes, so it's like the weird delineation. I just don't understand.
Yeah.
But eventually that went away. My parents separated, and they're like, we can't really keep track of what he's doing, so he can just watch whatever he wants.
Yeah, my parents divorced when I was 10, mm-hmm. and my brother and I lived with my mom, and she was remarkably permissive. Like, she would express concern. But this was 1978, and you know, we moved within Toronto up to a place that was walking distance from a magazine store that carried Fangoria. And
yeah.
I was like all over that.
Ugh.
And this was back in the days when, you know, oh, I can't remember the name of the actor, but from Friday the 13th Part 2, the severed head in the fridge, the Betsy Palmer's head in the fridge was on their cover because of the makeup. And
yeah.
It's just like it's abstracted to the point where it's like, I'm not frightened by this. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
How do you build this?
Because when you're like that involved in those kind of things, there's a level of like, well, I'm not taking these for face value. I'm taking them as them being constructed by artists, and that's what I find interesting.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't know, like, my mom didn't understand. My dad, he would just, as long as it wasn't rated R when we would go out, he'd let me rent stuff. And he probably had the best system ever, which we would go to Roger's Video, and he'd go, you can rent whatever you want. And then within 5 minutes, he's like, hurry up, let's go! So, like, a lot of, like, knee-jerk decisions would have to be made. And what kind of bit him in the butt and scared me was that he didn't understand what unrated meant, so I could take anything unrated and right. watch it. So, like, Dawn of the Dead was a huge one. The Toxic Avenger, which was unrated. A day I was sick at home and he was taking care of me, and he actually went, like, we can stop this if you want. And I was like, yeah, I don't like it very much, like, after the kid's head gets crushed.
Right.
But that was, like, and I guess you just, I got, like, acclimatized to that kind of stuff, and then I'm like, ooh, I want to know more. And but Army of Darkness was like a perfect kind of mixture, in the sense that, like, it was all this horror imagery, but I don't know if I was ready to, like, it be very visceral, because Army of Darkness is in your face, but it's not, like, horrifying.
It's way more fun.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's goofy, and it's just, like, in your face. Yeah. And that's what, like, really appealed to me,
which of course disappointed the horror fans.
Oh, they hated it. I remember reading reviews and being like, huh? Like, even the editor, Bob Murawski, Oscar-winning editor Bob Murawski for The Hurt Locker, who edited Army of Darkness, said, like, it wasn't really what I wanted to do. Like, I didn't even really like Evil Dead 2, he said. He's like, I was more of an Evil Dead 1 person.
Yeah, because when you were running through the list of unrated films, Evil Dead is the first thing that I thought of, which was my... Because Evil Dead is terrifying. Dead is... It's the only movie that billed itself as the ultimate experience in grueling horror.
Yeah, that's actually right. True. Which is funny, because, like, Sam Raimi, I remember reading a story that after the first screening, they got out, and one of the investors was like, I thought you were making a horror film, not a comedy. And he's like, oh, like, he's like, I thought I was making a horror film as well. I mean, like, I actually watched Army of Darkness with my family, my dad and my stepmom and my brother. And I remember vividly, like, my brother being like, I don't like this. This is scary. Because, like, we had probably watched Army of Darkness at that point together. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just an extension of that. Like, I'd read probably on the internet, like, oh, there's two movies before this.
Right.
And we went to go rent The Evil Dead, my dad knowing how much I love Army of Darkness. And what we were presented with, like, at that point, there's not even this is much cheaper. Like, me and my brother were just, like, taken aback by what we were seeing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is hilarious about that evolution of, like, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and then Army of Darkness.
Yeah, I mean, the first one is this grimy, despairing, terrifying, you know, meat grinder.
Yeah.
The second one is that, but also delightful.
Yeah, just fun.
Yeah, it's and, like, polished, it's clean, it's got, you know, it's got color.
Like, the first one, like, that energy is there, but it's all, like, shot from the hip or, like, the camera on the shoulder. You feel the three or four people who have been abandoned in the cabin because all the actors have left and they have to do these shots. And Sam Raimi is still being very, like, particular about the way he wants it, but it's still, like, grainy, super 16 mil. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Love it.
And then it gradually evolves into a goofy fantasy medieval comedy where Bruce Campbell's Ash is now just a full-on idiot.
Yes.
And it's delightful. It really is. But I can only imagine what it was like for people coming to Army first and then going back and going, oh, it wasn't always like that.
It's funny because, like, most people who came to Army first, I feel like they love the other movies as well, while people who started with Evil Dead, they think, like, Army of Darkness is like, oh, that's for children.
Yeah, it's
like
the redheaded stepchild.
Exactly. They're like, bah, you know, why can't they be, like, hardcore and, like, heavy metal like these original Evil Dead films? While people who start at Army are like, oh, I like the different ways that they can tell the story. Specifically that Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 are the same movie, just retold in, like, a different way with a different spin.
With you know, slightly more character expansion in that the professor shows up.
Yeah, that's right.
but it's amazing because I mean I interviewed Raimi about it at the time for Army of Darkness. There was this, I was going to Los Angeles for something in late 92, early 93, and Universal was supposed to set us up with a one-on-one. We still never met.
Oh, okay.
The timing didn't work out. Oh, it was Valentine's Day 93. That's what it was. I was going to Santa Barbara for a trip with an ex now. Her parents lived in Santa Barbara, so we were going to stay there for a week, and while we were there, we were going to go to Los Angeles for a couple of days, And that's when I was supposed to. So they showed me the movie. Mm-hmm. They screened it up at their screening room, the Universal screening room in Victoria Park in Shepherd, which is long since gone. And I was, I think it was me and two people from Universal who hadn't seen the film before. Mm-hmm. So I had a private screening effectively.
Of Army wow. Films,
which needs a crowd.
Yes.
Like, it played very... I mean, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But I'm like, this is kind of not what I thought it was
going to
be.
Yeah, I don't think anybody expected it to be that. Yeah. And it's Raimi really going back to what he's always said as, like, been his favorite thing about movies, which is, like, comedy and slapstick. And specifically, the punishing the innocent.
Yeah.
Which he loves! And I actually feel that, like, his... most recent horror films, Drag Me to Hell, I mean, we can talk about that a little bit later,
sure.
Is too far of, like, his punishing the innocent. I think Army of Darkness is the perfect film for a teenage boy to see because it's this big, grandiose, like, figure, Ash, and he's a joke. Like, yeah. The film treats him as a joke throughout. Even the ending that, like, the studio forced Raimi to tack onto it.
Yeah, the happy ending.
The happy ending is so absurd that it can only be read as satire. Like, even as a 12-year-old boy, you're like, this is crazy.
Yeah. It is, you know, now we're recording this the day after the Kavanaugh hearing, and just for context, I've been thinking a lot about white male privilege.
Yes.
And Ash is sort of the Detroit version of that guy. Like, mm-hmm. He is a swaggering, uninformed, unqualified dick.
Yes.
Who is good at one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's killing zombies.
Yes. When it comes to that, he's very good.
And actually, that's the thing. Like Raimi said, it's like, is it? What I'd said was like, I'm without any of the privilege stuff, which I hadn't thought about at all at the time. But we were saying like he said the joke of it is that Ash is absolutely useless unless he's killing zombies. And I said, is that because he thinks faster than everybody else? And Raimi said, oh, he doesn't think at all.
No.
And that's it though. You see it in Campbell's performance. Like he is a perfect reactive force in his movies in all three of them. And physically, he's interesting. Like he's always doing stuff with his arms and his shoulders, and his neck is funny at one point in Evil Dead 2.
Like
when he's bobbing up and down with the deer head, like he is so good at this one thing.
Like if you look at Bruce Campbell, like he's a handsome guy, but he's not too handsome to the point that you're like, oh, he could only play hero. He's kind of like a little scuzzy in that way.
No, he's a joke. He's a visual joke. That chin,
yes,
and the way he does the thing with his eyebrows, when you put them together in exactly the right way, that's just funny.
And just the way that like his voice sounds when he has to say these like ridiculous things. And in Army of Darkness, when you have him just being punished and punished throughout, like it's just funny. And I actually watched the director's cut last night, one that Sam Raimi prefers. And in that one, it almost like doesn't work because it kind of takes it's 16 minutes longer. And I've seen it before. And there's like a lot of parts that I really like. But like, the theatrical version is 81 minutes. And that's like short. And
it's
like,
a sprint. Yeah.
Just right through. And you can really get this like guy who he like thinks he's cool, but then they undercut him. And like a big thing in the director's cut is that there's like a love scene between him and Sheila, and they rightfully just took that out because they were like, what? No, like he should be a buffoon and to be treated that way. And while he may get a happy ending at the end, it is so over the top that like this feels like the fantasy that he would have of what would happen.
Yeah, because he shows up in the 13th century and immediately decides he's going to be in charge.
Yes.
Because he has a gun.
Yeah.
Which is, again, privilege.
Yes.
Which is the assumption that, oh, I'm from the future, his car has a high school science book, which puts him light years ahead of the wizards.
That's right.
Which is funny.
I mean, the wizards and blacksmiths who can create a mechanical hand for him that he can use.
That's far superior to anything that he ever came up with.
Like, yeah.
Okay, he strapped a chainsaw to it. Also good, also helpful.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's probably more practical ways he could do stuff, but it does look cooler if he does it that way.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, the Three Stooges were always something that were part of my life and my dad really liked them. But I think that like they reach fruition watching Army of Darkness, where like this kind of physical slapstick humor in the horror setting that I like so much.
Yeah.
Like that, like I'm like, ooh, I like that. Like I had no idea what splatstick was. I hadn't seen any like George Romero, like Dawn of the Dead. I probably had seen Night of the Living Dead at that point, but it hadn't clicked with me. That happened when I saw Dawn of the Dead. And like violence as a way of humor was something that I only associated with cartoons.
Right.
Like, live action, the way that Army of Darkness does it, was something that was completely foreign to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, no one had really, other than, maybe Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, where the monsters are value. Where,
yeah.
Like, the value is horror for them, but the characters aren't taking them seriously.
That's right.
Yeah, it's Bugs and the Monsters and Looney Tunes.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, as far as, like, monsters being treated seriously in a comedic way, one of the movies I'd seen when I was a kid was The Monster Squad.
I was just about to say.
Because that was in the 99-cent family section, so it was something I was allowed to rent. And I get, they must have not watched it with me, because, like, the Wolfman explodes in that movie, and it's gross.
It's pretty serious about what it's doing.
And that was, like, almost a little too serious for me. But it was Army of Darkness that finally clicked, like, oh, horror, or at least the iconography of horror, because Army of Darkness is not a horror film, it can be fun.
Yeah.
And that there's something that I gain value from when they're put together.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, all horror films have comic, well, almost all of them have comic relief as an element, because you need that to break them, with the exception of Evil Dead and maybe Halloween. And Night of the Living Dead doesn't have any laughs in it.
No.
But they're, like, those are films that are designed that way.
Yeah. Evil Dead, though, like, it's so unrelenting that, like, laughter is kind of, like, an escape valve.
Yeah, and it, like, just doesn't want you to have one.
Yeah, like, you're watching and you're like, oh my god, like, you've been chopped up! And, like, people, I feel like, when they see it for the first time, they tend to, almost try to laugh at the movie, because, like, the ropey performances, or, like, Scott being like, oh my god, when he's on the couch and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's only as it, like, goes on, and, like, Bruce Campbell's just freaking out. There's, like, that virtuoso sequence where he's, like, essentially just acting by himself, and, like, the camera is doing all these crazy things, like, going across the beams, and it's making loud, like, sound effects when it does it. Like, that's when you're like, whoa, like, this is something different than I've seen before.
Yeah. No, and that's the beauty of what Raimi does in all three films, is he is all in to the given concept.
Yes.
Whichever one it is, it's going to be the best version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be there with him until he's done.
Yes.
Which I really like. I like the idea that the first one gives you no release. The second one traps you in a funhouse ride, basically.
Yes.
Like, you can get up and leave, but you know you're going to miss stuff, so you just don't want to.
Yeah.
And then the third one is this, well, you know, there's a scene with some pipers in it, because that's what you would make in this movie. And
yeah.
Shut up. I'm doing it.
Army of Darkness honestly feels like, out of all the movies Raimi has made, that he could just do all the stuff that he loved as a kid. So whether it be, like, Three Stooges stuff, Ray Harryhausen skeletons, like, the Little People stuff, like...
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
That stuff that, like a 12-year-old, like, gets this idea, and he's like, wouldn't it be cool if you did this? And I mean, like, if you see Raimi in behind-the-scenes stuff, he is the excited kid who's, like, doing voices and, like, picking up the stuff and, like, slapping people with it. I mean, he loves to talk about how all the Evil Dead movies have, like, a scene where, like, Bruce Campbell's running or in a car and there's branches slapping him on the face, and Raimi would take great joy in being the person who could hold it and slap him.
I think it's really telling to me somehow that Raimi always makes a point. I don't know if he's doing it himself these days, but even now when they're talking about his shoots, he always comes to set in a suit and tie.
Yes.
Because that's what a grown-up would do.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not really a grown-up, and I like that about him. I admire it.
It's almost as if he wants to, like, present this veneer of, like, oh, I'm serious about what I'm doing. And then he picks up something and, like, slaps Bruce Campbell in the face.
Yeah,
he's like, hey, about it.
He can't not.
Yeah.
And Army is the perfect expression of that.
Mm-hmm.
Given his first studio... Well, no, Darkman was a studio picture, right?
Darkman was a studio picture, yeah.
But given, like, carte blanche, having proved himself with Darkman,
which was, like, a number one box office hit when it came out.
For a week.
Yep.
Yes. And I still love the fact that, you know, future Oscar nominee Liam Neeson and future Oscar winner Frances McDormand.
Yes, that's right.
Just point to it and go, this is the most absurdly overqualified of everything. And it's still good. Like, it works. And it has that same handmade thing with the scene in the... Nobody else would have had a shot of their hero dangling from a helicopter with his little feet running on the top of a truck.
Oh, that's so good.
But it's so humanizing. Like, that's how he sees these things.
I can understand, though, that, like, even Sam Raimi, I think pretty much after Army of Darkness, he decided, like, well, I want to be taken seriously. Like, we talked about that, like, showing up in a suit thing.
Mm-hmm.
He had that, like, run of movies, some of them very good, that were conscious efforts of him going, like, I don't want... you know, a simple plan to feel like a Sam Raimi movie, or For the Love of the Game.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
I am not a fan. And
was,
like,
The Gift his as well?
The Gift was his as well. Which you always get confused with The Watcher, where you're like, wait, is that The Gift, or is that the...
There's the one where Keanu Reeves is the bad guy, and then there's the one where Keanu Reeves is the incidental bad guy.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, no, saw them all.
And after that, it feels like he just went, like, ah, screw it, and he made The Quick and the Dead, which is, like, the Sam Raimi as Sam Raimi that you could ever get. And, like, I feel like that's the mode that he's the most comfortable in. And it's kind of a bummer. Like, I don't know if he still, I don't want to say has it in him, but maybe he just looks at it and he's like, I've done everything that I want to do. Like, I made 3 Spider-Man movies, one of them seemingly against my will. Yeah. And
he does kind of feel like a hostage to his own vision on the third one.
Yeah, he did. If you hear him talk about the first one, a lot of those Sam Raimi flourishes are stuff that the producers were like, oh, you should do this.
Yeah.
Because he was trying to avoid it.
And it's perfectly suited. And that's why the second one works as well as it mm-hmm. does, because it is about people in yeah. the middle of this giant cartoon universe that he's built. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, like, that's Army of Darkness, and mm-hmm. maybe not so much Quick and the Dead, which is the cartoon universe sort of takes over.
Yeah, it's like Quick and the Dead is a successful version of Crime Wave, his second film,
yeah.
which I really like Crime Wave. I wouldn't recommend it, and I always say it's not funny. And, like, I mean, Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell...
It has its moments.
It's so, like, visually, like, in your face, but it was taken away from them, it was re-edited, like, on set, it didn't really work. And, like, the lead actor, someone that was put upon them as opposed to Bruce Campbell, who they wanted.
Right.
So you can feel all of these things kind of, like, fighting against each other. But at the same time, like, one of the bad guys is voiced by Sam Raimi, because the actor, they had such a difficult time that, like, he dubbed his voice. So there's little touches here and there, but that's when, like, the cartoon universe is completely taking over. And that, like, there's less... Like, I can enjoy it, but it's less engaging, I feel.
You don't feel his hands on the wheel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember at the time when they finally released the video, I think I even reviewed it at the time, because mm-hmm. I was writing for a home video mag at the time The Star was putting out, and it's just like, oh, this is Miller's Crossing, except directed by a maniac. Like, it's yeah. the idea of, you can see the intersection with him and the Coens there. And in the Hudsucker Proxy, the Crime Wave and Hudsucker are the ones that come closest to the two sensibilities.
Sam Raimi shot Second Unit on Hudsucker Proxy. Yeah,
and
so.
You can totally mm-hmm. feel it. And you can also feel in those moments, it's like, oh yeah, of course they're friends. Like,
yeah
they get along.
They have the same sensibilities, but while the Coens will do 2 to 3 Sam Raimi shots in a movie, Sam Raimi will be like, let's do 150.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the difference between both of them, and that's why, like, the Coen brothers can be taken more seriously, while Sam Raimi is like, nah, I just want to entertain, like, I just want to have fun. Yeah. And it's distancing to some people, because this kind of in-your-face, like, excessiveness, they just, like, take a step back and go, like, well, I can't engage with this.
Right.
Because, like, the auteur is too present, or it's too goofy, and because it's goofy, I can't take it seriously.
Right.
Like, there's, like, weird layers there that, thankfully, like, he was able to, you know, get successes like Darkman or Spider-Man, which is, I mean, he says he loved the character, and it's probably because it's the perfect Sam Raimi character, this put-upon loser who still does the right thing at the end of the day.
Yeah. A secretly wonderful nebbish.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of his deal.
Yeah, and I mean, like, and... you know, Ash in Army of Darkness is that, but he is just a loser.
Yeah.
Like,
no, Ash sees himself as Peter Parker, but he's really Flash Thompson.
Yeah, exactly. He is 100% Flash. He's not even Flash Thompson. Like, he's not cool.
Yeah.
Like,
that's right. He's Billy Zane in Back to the Future. He's the other guy.
Yeah, that's right.
That's possible.
But he's good at this one thing that he'll do. And the movies will always have him, like, succeed at the end, because, like, he has to do this because this is the one thing he's good at.
Yeah.
But everyone around him will die in the process.
Yeah.
And only he will be left standing.
Well, and it's also, you know, like, the first two Evil Deads punish Ash for his success, right?
Because
he gets eaten at the end, technically.
Yes.
And then it turns out not to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second one, it's like, ah, you know what? We're just going to throw you back to the 13th century so you can't bother us anymore.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a mistake,
mm-hmm.
demon-wise. But there was I think it might have even been Fangoria. There was an interview with Raimi once where he said that, like, his original vision for Evil Dead is that humanity is tested every 100 or every 1,000 years,
mm-hmm.
and Ash is our guy. And, like, that's what it means. Like,
yeah.
it's going to suck to have this guy be your champion,
mm-hmm.
just because he was there in the room.
And, like,
and nobody else survived.
And it's the worst thing, because he's very good at what he does, but he can't save the people around him.
Yeah.
And, like, that says so much about, like, Raimi's view on humanity and, like how things go, not forward, but how he just views us. And, like, and it's funny, because, like, misery in this context is like, oh my God, I just can't believe that, like, I'm laughing at this stuff. Like, Three Stooges again, against someone in life or death situations.
Yeah. No, if you step back and you appreciate what's going on, mm-hmm. it's actually incredibly tragic.
Yes.
Except it's not, because it's so much fun.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that it's like that mixture of both things, which is, like, really fun, and then it's like, kind of sad. Like, everyone that Ash knows has died.
Yeah.
Mostly because of kind of stuff that he's done or didn't do.
Or he's had to kill them.
Yes,
right?
Because they've become evil.
Exactly. He's killed a version of them.
Yes.
That pleaded for its life.
And if he thinks back on it, he's like, oh, but wait, if I just waited in Army of Darkness, then, like, they can be magically healed by the power of love.
Yeah.
Like,
meh.
Doesn't matter. I mean, Raimi is the first person to say, like, ah, rules don't matter. Because, like, the rules of Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness, it's just whatever is fun. Like, skeleton hands can come popping out of every side of the screen to punch Ash in the face. Because that's what the funniest thing that could happen.
Yeah. I mean, he gets poked in the eyes. For, like, a proper Three Stooges boink. You can hear it.
Yeah. Boink, boink. Yeah.
And he just loves it so much.
He just loves that. He just... I mean, I don't want to say he loves suffering, because that sounds like a crazy person, but he loves suffering.
He loves making his friends suffer.
Yes, he does, especially Bruce Campbell.
Well, that's it, right? Like, there's this unspoken understanding, certainly by the time we get to Army, that he can take it.
Mm-hmm.
That Ash can take it, but mostly that Bruce Campbell is willing to do this to himself.
What's interesting about that is that during Drag Me to Hell, there's a new Blu-ray that came out by Scream Factory, and Alison Lohman, I believe that's her name, is interviewed on the disc, and she says it was a miserable experience because she was treated like essentially Bruce Campbell would be.
Right.
And watching Drag Me to Hell, like, there is a weird kind of like power dynamic about what's going on, where when Bruce Campbell, when he's suffering, it's funny. Alison Lohman suffering in Drag Me to Hell, in my opinion, and I know a lot of people love this movie, it's not fun?
No, she's giving a real performance.
Yeah, and I think...
She's a person. Mm-hmm. Ash is never a person. He's always a cartoon.
And I think there's, like, a tonal inconsistency in that, where, like, Drag Me to Hell and the way it ends, I'm like, ugh, like, that's not fun. While, like, the way that Evil Dead 2 or even Evil Dead ends, I'm like, like, that's fun. Like,
yeah.
It's a weird kind of thing, and I wonder if, like, Raimi's like, it's not the same anymore because I'm not making these with my friends.
I'm almost sure that that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Drag Me to Hell is this really fascinating conflict between what he wants to do and what the world expects from horror now.
Yeah.
Especially because he was talking at the time about how it comments on the, you know, it was about the foreclosure crisis and the mortgage meltdown, and it's all about economic anxiety, which is a legitimate thing in Drag Me to Hell, not just an excuse for racism, although
yes,
there is some of that.
Yes.
But the gypsy woman is such a caricature, and Alison Lohman, as presented in the film, her character is a reasonable person, right? Like, she makes a selfish choice.
She does, yeah.
But the movie makes it okay for her, which is what the Evil Dead films do.
Yeah.
But then as she is punished for this choice, the enthusiasm for it that the Evil Dead movies have and that we get to share in isn't there.
Yeah. And I think that's like the big issue that I have with it. It's like just the world that Sam Raimi is working through in Drag Me to Hell. Like, I love the idea that he went back and he's like, I'm just going to make a Spookablast kind of movie. Like, go back to the... And it just was never there. I own it on Blu-ray. Like, okay. I bought it.
It's
like,
up there. I got it.
I was just like, you know, maybe one day I'll come to terms with it. But, like, watching that interview with Alison Lohman being like, oh, like, I felt like... She doesn't say abuse. She uses, like, another word, but essentially gets down to that.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah, you can see that on screen. And it's not, like, fun in that way anymore.
And it's the Tales from the Crypt thing.
Where
at half an hour, you can get someone... who, you know, you can get a story of an asshole who's given a comeuppance.
But at 90 minutes, it's tough.
And she's not an asshole.
She's not an asshole enough.
Yeah. She's too human. She's too real.
Yes.
And the beauty of the Evil Dead movies is that although in the first film, the violence feels real, that's the only thing that feels real. Like, the world itself is just, I mean, it's a nightmare, but it's a nightmare that is stylized just enough to remove us from, oh my God, these poor people.
Well, I mean, like, the actors in the Evil Dead movie, like, they're jerks, like, throughout. Like, there's a reason that Evil Dead the musical, there's, like, a big comedy bit where one of the characters calls one of the women, like, just a stupid bitch because, like, it's so... like, the kind of characters that are in The Evil Dead, like, they would say that kind of stuff, which is like, ugh, why did you say that?
Right. But the musical knows it.
Yes, that's what I mean. The musical knows it, and that's why it highlights it. But in the movie, Sam Raimi doesn't quite seem to know how jerky his characters are, just because he's overwhelmed by everything else that's going on around it.
Yeah.
So that when Ash is finally alone in the movie, that's when it, like, pops, where you feel like just Raimi and Bruce Campbell just head-to-head, just essentially giving each other noogies.
Yeah.
But not in a mean, bullying way, in a way that they're like, like, they're just having fun.
Yeah.
I was going to say that, like, on The Evil Dead, though, like the Josh Becker, which was part of that friend group, he felt like he was outside of it when they were making that movie. Like, he would go on to be a filmmaker himself. He made Thou Shall Not Kill, which Sam Raimi stars in.
That's right.
But you get that idea of, like, if you're not within that group, and when you're watching the movie, you feel within that group. There is that, like, distancing effect, which I can feel, like, people who don't like the Evil Dead films, they maybe feel that way, where they're like, ah, if you did this, or it would look more polished, it'd be more scary, when it's really just these friends being like, ah, yeah, we're white guys, and we're just pushing each other into bushes, like, just having fun, not a worry in the world.
Yeah, and it somehow... It's everybody who's ever dreamed of making a movie with their friends.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's, that's what the, did you ever see the Christopher Guest movie, The Big Picture?
A long time ago. Yeah. And I vividly remember each short film that's presented in that film.
Right.
Because the film is like Kevin Bacon's a short filmmaker, and it starts with him like...
At the student film festival.
Yeah. And like Christopher Guest just highlights perfectly like each... kind of like the pretentious film, the in-your-face, like, you have, like, the Contra/Hitchcock zoom where the camera's pulling back and zooming in and the person is pointing. Yeah, it, like, that feeling of, like... Yeah.
It romanticizes the experience of making a movie with your friends while ignoring the fact that no one will like it because there's no one to comment on the outside and say, you know, you're only making this for you and your friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I think The Evil Dead is one of maybe... handful, if that, of those movies that works,
mm-hmm.
if you get onto its vibe. And I can totally understand the response of people who say, oh, it doesn't do it for me. I get that.
Oh, I completely agree as well, yeah.
But it's the movie for the people who spent, you know, 6 hours in the diner after Dawn of the Dead.
Yes. Being like, oh, if we did this or that. And I mean, like, Army of Darkness, one of the big reasons that I came to it is... the cinematic style, like, basically, like, in broad strokes, just writing with the camera.
Yeah.
Like, I think the camera, at that point, was not something that I was conscious of before I, like, sat down and watched Army of Darkness all in one go. Just because, you know, Spielberg, he's doing crazy stuff, like in Jurassic Park or E.T., but it's so integrated in what's going on, I'm never like, ah, like this shot. And Army of Darkness is like, look at this shot. Isn't it crazy? And, like, when I started making movies with my friends, like, I don't have any actors, so by saying something with the camera, that's how you can let the audience know, like, look at this crazy stuff that I'm doing. Like, if I have no money, I have no time, I have no production value, the camera and the way that you tell the story, essentially, like, raising your voice and, like, waving your arms, that's what hopefully will be interesting enough for the people that are watching it.
Yeah, and it is the kind of movie, Army of Darkness specifically, mm-hmm. where he has a machine behind him.
Like, yes.
He is being indulged because he's made two of these already, and there's trust that he can deliver the thing that they want. And he delivered something which was not the thing that they wanted.
No.
But it looked like it for a little while.
It's weird because, like, I don't know what Dino De Laurentiis wanted if they're spending that much money. They obviously wanted a PG-13 movie.
Yeah. The only thing Dino De Laurentiis ever wanted was a return on investment.
That's right.
And he didn't get it with this.
No, he didn't.
No, which is perversely fascinating to me because I do like the movie. I'm not trying to
denigrate
it. But, you know... you give that money, you give $12 or $13 million or whatever it was to the guy who made these three films that you can look at on the shelf behind you, or four if you count Crime Wave.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, he's going to use that money to do the thing he wants to do
on
a bigger scale.
I mean, like, Sam Raimi said that when he started Darkman, he wanted to make, like, a real movie and, like, not do what he did in The Evil Dead and Crime Wave. And he's, like, just couldn't help himself.
I know, he comes back to it.
And it's, like, Army of Darkness is the one that essentially, like, just took the wind out of his sails for a while, because you do get stuff like A Simple Plan, which is good, and it's like, oh, wow, you can do this, but we know you're not having as much fun as you want to.
I mean, I remember seeing it theatrically and going, and I'd read the book, and I actually ran into Ben Stiller. I'm just going to drop names. Because Stiller was going to direct it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That would have been more stylized than what Raimi would have done.
Well,
so.
Apparently not. That's the fascinating thing. Yeah, I met him in passing in a hotel in 94. I was in New York for the... what was the junket? Oh, for the Nobody's Fool junket. The Paul Newman film, Robert Benton movie. Really good.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And Crooklyn was junketing there as well. And then for whatever reason, Stiller was in the lobby of this this hotel in Midtown, the Riga Royale, near Times Square, where they were holding all of this stuff. And I cornered him because I knew who he was. And I'd seen the Ben Stiller show.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew he had the rights to the book, which I'd read. And I'm like, what are you going to do? Because Nicolas Cage was going to star in it.
Huh.
And he said, it's going to be... really, really grim. That's all he said.
Okay.
And then, you know, I said, okay, cool. And we...
yeah, yeah.
This weird kid in his 20s bothering the movie star. So I just... that was the only thing we had said. And then the Raimi movie came out. I was like, well, yeah, it's grim.
Yeah.
Okay. It's also not a Sam Raimi movie, really.
No.
That makes me sad.
Yeah. Like, I'd be curious to know what, like, if Army of Darkness had been a hit, and then Sam Raimi...
Yeah, where does the career go from there?
Like, let's say even he gets A Simple Plan. Like, what would that version of A Simple Plan look like? Probably just, like, an over-caffeinated Blood Simple.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I mean, like, you know, I have a very good idea of what it would look like.
They would have kept the original ending, which is not in the book.
Oh, I don't even know what the original ending is. Oh, it's,
everybody gets punished.
Oh, really?
Just punished terribly. There's, like, there's a dead child. He has to kill people in a convenience store.
Yeah.
I think they kind of write around it in the movie.
Yeah.
But... it's just like somebody spends one bill and he has to go track it down and kill three people who have it. It's just...
That feels like something that would have attracted Sam Raimi to the movie to do that kind of stuff.
I was like... because when he got the job, it's like, oh, well, he'll go there. He'll do it. And, yeah. I think, weirdly enough, I think Stiller would have gone there.
I think Stiller would have gone there.
Nicolas Cage apologetically murder people.
Yeah, especially... you know, you can take that film different ways, and with Raimi, the over-the-topness was what he was known for, so he probably didn't want to go that far.
Yeah, he's fighting against his best instincts.
While Ben Stiller is like, oh, like, I want to be taken seriously, so I will go that over-the-top and grim, but like in a different way than Sam Raimi would.
He would have more to prove than... like, Raimi has something to prove with A Simple Plan that isn't the thing we want him to prove.
Yes. And, like, it... I mean, it's a bummer that Army of Darkness didn't make a lot of money when it came out, but it's obvious that there's a rabid fan base for it. Every DVD
release.
Like, is it released,
the most released movie?
I feel like
it
is.
It's that or Halloween, right?
When I first got a DVD player, the first two DVDs I owned were Army of Darkness and probably its first DVD incarnation, which it had the like Frazetta-ish cover of Ash with his shirt ripped
ridiculous
open.
Ridiculous muscles.
So hilarious. I mean, it's not as ridiculous as if you've seen the international poster, which is like Ash with his head back and even more muscled than he is on the American
triumphant boomstick.
Yeah. And I got Evil Dead on one of those Anchor Bay release. I guess it was a collector's. They were like clear cases instantly.
Yeah,
like, because the hinges broke off.
Yeah, yeah. I had that too.
And
oh no, it wasn't a slider. It was the
clear case that opened up.
Case.
What you see now in like dollar stores when it's like public domain movies trying to sell it to you. Look, it looks different. And
I still have one or two of them somewhere.
After that, like, there was a million versions of Army of Darkness. Like, they couldn't get enough. And I mean, I can understand that there's the hunger there because like, oh, there's a director's cut. There's an international version. On the Blu-ray, there's all those and a TV version.
Yep.
Like,
well, because Universal was doing that a lot. Like, the Brazil TV version is the best example.
Right.
But there's a different cut of The Thing. There's a bunch of stuff they sold into syndication. I think Army of Darkness might have been the last one.
Because
that was starting to die out in the early 90s. But Universal's TV department had quite the operation going, where they were just running around... disgracing and
just padding them out with deleted scenes as well to like make them longer. I wonder if I watched the TV version, I'd be like,
yeah, because an 81-minute movie wouldn't fit a 2-hour slot.
No,
they'd have to add another. I think the average was 93 or 97.
Yeah, so they would probably have to add in a bunch of deleted scenes that would. I'm curious to know what it is. Man, I'm gonna have to run home and watch that TV version. Nah, I think I'm good. Armor of Darkness again is a movie though that I was talking with a friend last night, and he's like, I've seen it so many times that I can't watch it anymore.
Right.
Because and it's curious to me that, like, the reaction that I had right on seeing it without any cultural baggage around it, a lot of people also had that reaction. So I think it's also because it is in such broad strokes and the iconography is, like, right there. It's, like, the beginner's version of these things.
Right.
Like, oh, yeah, I like this line that he says. I'm going to repeat it to my friends. Because, like, it's so in your face. Again, the expression I've been using so much right now.
Yeah.
That, like, it's the perfect entry point. It's, like really good pop music.
Yeah, but it's got quips you can use out of context.
Exactly.
It's got a swagger to it. It's very, very silly.
Yes.
And it's welcoming in a way that a lot of other stuff at the time wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
As a gateway to horror, it's just a really bad one because it's not a horror movie.
I think it's a pretty good one because...
it's a gateway to Raimi.
Yeah, but especially, like... horror, depending on how you approach it. Like, everybody, like, does it differently. Like, some people are like, well, I want it to be hardcore. And I want to be, like, serious.
Yeah.
And other people are like, well, I like both. Like, I like to laugh, and I like the idea of monsters and the fantastical. Essentially what existed in the 80s.
Yeah.
And, like, then you give me your Exorcists and all the other stuff that is supposed to be taken seriously.
Yeah, I'm much more of a... just because, I guess, of how old I am. Mm-hmm. I came up, like, I was 10 when Halloween opened.
Yeah.
And Slasher Wave started. But I'm way more of a... how can I even put this without sounding incredibly pretentious? American Werewolf in London.
Yes.
The Thing. Mm-hmm. Stuff with monsters, stuff with makeup, but stuff that was self-aware.
Yes.
But not to the point of Scream where, which I mean, I like Scream.
Which is meta.
But it's meta. Yeah, exactly. That's different. Like, The Thing has moments where the actors can play and
like, whoa, like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. But it also has, you've got to be fucking kidding.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Where you can actually take a moment and laugh at how obscene all of this stuff is. Mm-hmm. Or Werewolf for Halloween. Mm-hmm. Like, The Howling.
Yeah, The Howling. Which blends. Is almost closer to Sam Raimi-ish. Yeah, like, yeah. The werewolf, like, tapping her on the shoulder and stuff like that.
Yeah,
like,
it's goofy, but it's also scary. Mm-hmm. And it respects both.
Yeah.
And then, I'm a Hellraiser originalist. Like, only the first one. And that was sort of this fundamental moment for me. Like, I've always loved the Romero zombie movies and the monsters. But, you know, Hellraiser is that wonderful moment of the intersection of awful things outside of our world, mm-hmm. happening to awful people.
Yeah.
And the Evil Dead movies kind of pick that up too.
Here. Yeah. I mean, like, speaking of violence in the Evil Dead movies, I mean, Bruce Campbell, I believe it's in his biography, talks about cutting together a, like, TV version of Evil Dead 2. And that it's way more horrifying when you put it on someone's face reacting to something that you can't see.
Yeah.
And you just hear the noise and stuff like that, because a human brain is going to be like, oh my God, like, what could be happening off frame, especially if you hold on it for that long.
Yeah, and you're empathizing with pain, too.
Exactly. And when you just show it, you're like, okay. And because us as human beings, we've never had an arm chopped off or, like, heads lopped off, we can't associate that with any kind of real, like, hurtful emotion.
Sure.
So that's why it turns into, like, and, like, laughter and stuff like that, because it is so over the top.
Yeah, it's something that no other series really connects to in the same way. Mm-hmm. The glee of dismemberment.
Yeah, especially, like, that it did start serious and that it goes so goofy. I mean, like, a lot of people have tried to pick up the torch and do that kind of Sam Raimi-ish thing, and it's interesting to see, like, how it doesn't work or how people don't understand, like, what they like about these things. Like, a lot of people will take the iconography of Ash and, like, this cool stuff and try to treat it as it being cool. And you're like, well, it doesn't work because, like, it's a joke. And especially if you don't marry it to, like, crazy camera choreography to just underline that this is a cartoon, then you have an issue.
Well, and almost no one else can do Bruce Campbell.
Nobody can do Bruce Campbell. Right?
Like, there are a couple of people who, you know, like Treat Williams in Deep Rising.
Ooh, love Treat Williams in Deep Rising, right? Yeah.
That's the kind of performance where it's not the same at all, mm-hmm. but it is the similar kind of attitude that comes through, where it's like, I am complicit in this movie's joke. Mm-hmm. I am part of it, I know, and we're still going to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody does that in the context of horror anymore, or ever did, I don't think. Like, Campbell could do it.
Yeah, but as far as horror movies go, like,
people who try fail.
I mean, speaking of Stephen Sommers, Hugh Jackman and Van Helsing, like, that is not good.
No.
And that's a movie that you're like, how is this not good? And it makes you realize, like, how, like, much of a...
How valuable Fraser is to it.
Yeah,
to
especially in The Mummy. I was going to say Bruce Campbell, but, like, Brendan Fraser is doing Bruce Campbell in The Mummy.
Yeah.
Just like...
It's a little more sensitive.
The Alex Kurtzman movie, The Mummy. Basically, Tom Cruise is playing a Bruce Campbell type.
Right.
But you can't take it seriously because he's handsome.
Yeah.
And he just seems like a jerk in a way that Bruce Campbell... He's a jerk, but he's a lovable jerk. Tom Cruise in the Mummy remake is just like, I don't like that.
Well, that is such a weird role for him to play anyway, Cruise.
Yes.
Because he's trying to put his usual gravitas and determination into a monster movie. Mm-hmm. And you can feel, like, the movie treats him like an antibody and rejects it.
Yes!
As much as I dislike that film, and I frankly hate it.
Do you own it on Blu-ray?
I have it. I never bought it. They sent it to me.
Really? It supposedly has 2 hours of making of features.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, I love that stuff. If it's, like, a really bad movie and there's 2 hours of it, I'm like, I'm going to just eat that up. Yeah, you give me that Total Recall remake.
And you want to borrow it.
And try to justify, like, why you made the movie that you made.
Yeah, that is a movie that I think, like, there was talk of Raimi taking over the horror project for years and years. Like, wasn't he trying to make Dr. Jekyll as a standalone?
I don't know. I mean, like, Raimi always had, like, weird relationships with properties that he wanted to remake because, like, he wanted to make The Shadow, and they just wouldn't give it to him. And that's, like, a perfect marriage of his sensibilities. And so he ended up making Darkman. That's why, like, the face is changing and stuff like that. Like, kind of the mad scientist milieu. And I don't know what he would do with, like, Universal Monsters. I feel Sam Raimi wouldn't treat them with much respect. And I don't think people would like that.
I don't think there's anywhere to go with Universal Monsters at this point. I mean, they keep trying. And
give it to Blumhouse. Give them, like, $2 million films. And you make, like, a Dracula film and a Frankenstein movie. Don't make them action films.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? Like, even the... it wasn't Summers. Who was it? Joe Johnston did The Wolfman.
Yeah.
And it's terrible.
But that was supposedly a, like, horrifying experience for everyone involved.
Oh,
like,
you can totally tell.
It caused...
Emily Blunt won't even talk about it.
It caused Rick Baker to pretty much retire from special effects afterwards.
Okay.
And because it was Mark Romanek was supposed to direct The Wolfman.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then Joe Johnston, the utility player of, like, the Hollywood scene, just came in and he's like, I'll finish it.
Yeah. For it's just... But I think what these movies keep saying, and what The Mummy weirdly proved, the new Mummy, in its way, is that you can't tell them in period, and you can't tell them in the present day. Like, these monsters don't have a purpose anymore, because we've moved beyond them. Like, now you get the best creature from the Black Lagoon movie in 50 years, and it's Shape of Water.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not about the creature, it's about the people.
I still feel like they could do it, but, I mean, we're way off topic now. But, like...
Yeah, Raimi could do Frankenstein. That's the one that I keep thinking about.
Starring Bruce Campbell?
Well, he's so fascinated... As the monster.
Yeah, as the monster.
He's so fascinated with pieces, right? Like, he could maybe come up with a way, but at the same time, I want to see him just follow his bliss at this point.
Yeah.
Like, don't make an Oz movie anymore.
I don't know what that Oz thing... I'm sure he had, like, third house he had to pay off or something like that.
Like, that's somebody getting insurance.
Yes.
Not Raimi. That's Disney going, well, who can we give it to who can handle a project of this size? Oh, he made Spider-Man. Let's get him.
And if you hear Raimi talk about it, there were some elements that, like, really interested him of, like, doing practical stuff. But then when you hear him talk about it, he sounds like Robert Zemeckis talking about it, where, like, oh, no, you're not passionate about this thing. You just want to do this one or two little tricks in the movie.
Yeah, the technical challenges.
The technical challenges. While it doesn't really interest you to actually tell the story and to get energized.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, I don't know where Sam Raimi has to go after this, but, I mean, maybe he'll make little movies. He produced a movie for his wife.
Yeah.
Like, I think that was the last thing that he did major. He directed the Evil Dead TV show pilot.
Yeah, he's involved with it, but not that close. Yeah. It's mostly Tappert's show, as I understand.
It's Tappert's show. And now it's done. So, yeah, that's it for that. Maybe he'll retire. Who knows? Like, he gave us a lot of entertainment. And obviously, like, even you look at something at Army of Darkness, and you listen to everybody that was involved talk about it, and how tiring it was to do, just to put together this, like, confectionery that's just supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
Like, I saw Bill Pope when they did the Right Stuff screenings at the Bloor Cinema, and Edgar Wright was showing movies. They did a screening of Army of Darkness, and Bill Pope came, and he said, like, this is how the movie should be shown. All battered and crummy looking and filled with splices. Like, that's the way that, like, Sam Raimi would have loved it. And you almost want to feel like, he's joking, but at the same time, it's like, oh, this was obviously such a punishing experience on everyone involved. And I just don't know if, you know, Raimi can do that anymore. Like, the system is not built anymore for them to, like, do these big roller coasters that are expected to make $100 million, unless it's Oz. And Oz is, man,
it's nothing anybody wants.
It's nothing I want. Yeah. Like,
really, like, not even kids liked it. It's just one of those things that everyone went to see.
Who is it for? Like, I mean, some people would say, like, it made me think of The Evil Dead. And I'm like, okay, well, I can go see The Evil Dead. Like, I wish Raimi would just do something else. I mean, I will always have Army of Darkness and The Evil Dead series and all the other Sam Raimi movies I like. Spider-Man 1, 2,
sure.
1/4 of Part 3, I guess.
I keep wanting to go back to it. And that's the Raimi thing. I know there's stuff in there that
the
I
Blu-ray
like.
Box set that was recently released has a new edit of the movie that Bob Murawski did himself. It was not really advertised.
Of three. I remember they did the Spider-Man
2.5.
Yeah.
But yeah, 3 is like an edit that Bob Murawski, it's called the Editor's Cut. It's only on the box set that was released when the Spider-Man Homecoming came out.
Oh.
So you should check it out if you have it on Blu-ray.
I do not have that box, I don't think.
It just came out of nowhere, and, like, the fact that Bob Murawski was actually involved, it doesn't fix the movie. You can't fix the movie.
No.
But it does some really interesting stuff where you're like, oh, you should have done that instead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Raimi is one of those guys who, as he gets more money, gets less interesting, and it's not his fault.
No, I don't think it's his fault.
He's more answerable. and he has to rein in his instincts.
Well, it's that problem where, like, Spider-Man 1 and 2 are massive hits, and Spider-Man 2 is obviously Raimi doing whatever he wants, and then people get involved. It's too big a machine,
yeah.
And that people are like, well, I want this input, or I want that input. Why is the third film the most compromised out of all of them yeah. when the person has delivered two massive hits?
Yeah, and you've heard the same excuses I have, that it was supposed to be a two-parter, that it was going to be 3 and 4, and then this massive story was going to work, and it's just like, yeah, but that was never going to happen.
No, and like...
totally tell. And maybe now they could get away with something like that. I mean, obviously they can.
Yeah.
The Avengers movies.
But not at that time. And Raimi didn't like Venom. Like, yeah. that's the big issue with Spider-Man 3, which is Raimi, he said very vocally, like, he didn't understand the character. He didn't know why people liked him.
Yeah, no, he was being saddled with this thing mm-hmm. in the franchise he created, which is so frustrating. Like, there would be no Spider-Man 3 if he hadn't made the first one.
I know, and you have people, like, the producers coming in and being like, oh, well, I think you should actually do this. Maybe the success of the movie was really all me yeah. and not you. When you look at the movies and you're like, no. The success of these films is Sam Raimi 100%. Nobody else would have cast Tobey Maguire, who you look back at those movies, and he's the biggest weenie around. yeah, as like much. The lead superhero and I remember when it was coming out, like, it didn't seem that tonally dissonant, but I watch it now versus all the superhero yeah, films I'm where sure. you're like, oh, they look like the superhero move the way superheroes should look, and you look at Tobey Maguire and you're like, ah, Sam Raimi, he just understood that yeah. like he wanted to have like the Weasley Steve Ditko Peter Parker yeah. who's like so whiny that you're like, oh yeah, that's why he gets bullied.
Yeah, spindly and wet-eyed in a way
exactly
people aren't supposed to be.
Yeah,
but it's yeah the it's the same instinct that puts Bruce Campbell in his movies mm-hmm. where, you know, that guy looks weird.
Yes,
I want him
mm-hmm. and he'll do all this stuff that I want to do to him, and yeah. like he'll just allow me to do it. Yeah, and he'll smile, and you know, his back may hurt now, but yeah. we had fun while we did it
forever.
Yeah,
what I did to him.
I mean, Bruce Campbell used to do a thing. I just read an interview yesterday where someone said that when he won the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors thing, he would do the flip where he like grabs the back of his head and he flips himself forward, and he used to do it all the time. And one day he's like, I can't do it anymore. And, I mean, it's great that Bruce Campbell was able to do the TV series, which, I mean, you know, compared to Army of Darkness, like, the Ash versus the Evil Dead show seemed for 2 seasons trying to figure out what it wanted to be.
Yeah.
Like, am I supposed to take it seriously? Am I not? Are we too beholden to the Evil Dead? Like, it can't be Deadites every episode, because that's, like, boring. And, like, it did for 2 seasons, like, I don't know. The 3rd season, I think they just figured it out. Yeah. And it was canceled.
I heard it got really good at the end. I haven't got there
yet. Yeah, they got a new showrunner. And he just, like, he knows what people want. Like, the thing about the Evil Dead movies as well is that when you watch them, you're like, anything goes. A big head comes crashing through the wall in Evil Dead 2.
Sure.
Yeah, happened. Fine. Yep. Skeleton hands pop up, little ashes. Like, that's what's fun about them. And when you get too stuck on, like, they're Deadites, it's like, that's not why we like it. Like, yeah. And it's just figuring that out. What is the most fun? Just like you're telling your friend a story and you're just getting crazy. Like, this happens and then this happens. And that's what the most fun, especially Army of Darkness. That's what it feels like. Someone telling you a story and seeing how you're like kind of getting into it. So they're going more and more over the top. You imagine the script to be all like bold and underline and exclamation points and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, Army of Darkness is the second wind.
Yes.
It's like when you, oh, this is what you want. And you lean into it.
I mean, it makes sense that like it was Sam Raimi and Ivan Raimi, his brother, wrote it together. Because it's like two guys just like double daring themselves to go more and more over the top. And they have this big machine behind them to do it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, ultimately, it is exactly the movie they wanted to make,
yes.
which I think is why it feels so personal and warm and nice, and also so unsatisfying as horror.
It's weird because like they have dismissed the theatrical cut. They only believe in the director's cut, right. which I'm like, guys, you should watch the director's cut again, because it's very kind of like baggy in a way that the movie shouldn't be.
But that's what I mean. Like,
yeah.
That's their baby.
Mm-hmm.
So now, of course, they're still like, 25 years later, they have to protect it.
Yes, I guess. Yeah.
Even though it's not looking so heavy, you know, it's walking with a limp. There's something wrong with it.
Yeah. They can't take a second look where they're like, oh, maybe they were right to amputate my child. Like, it's more aerodynamic. It could win those races.
Yeah. This is where we are. It does, you've kind of addressed it, but, you know, it does bring us to the closer on the show, which is always the same question, which is, you know, what, is there anything of Army of Darkness specifically or the Evil Dead trilogy in general that you've borrowed, stolen, incorporated in camera stuff?
100%, especially like a sense of humor. I mean, the first movie that I made, like the lead was like a buffoon because it was my friend Christian, and he's not an actor, and he's just like, oh yeah, I'll be in a feature film for you. And he just like, I don't want to say I tortured him, but I tortured him like in the coal and splattering blood on his face and just doing all this kind of stuff. So not only did I take that kind of aesthetic of Evil Dead, I also took like, well, look at me, look at all the camera stuff that I'm doing. And
this is Teddy Bomb.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Teddy Bomb, which received a middling review in Now Magazine.
It's funny. I mean, I got what you were doing, but at the same time, there's this whole other thing where it was in the middle of a film festival.
Yes.
And it was, you know, it was the film that was the most, I mean, simultaneously the most obviously handmade, the most obviously personal, but also just didn't feel like a full movie in the same way. I mean, you post-sync the whole thing, and there was a sense of, just a sense, there was a definite sense of people having fun and doing the thing together, but I didn't feel, my experience of it, watching it on a, like on a proper screen, not this one, but the one I had before, was that, oh yeah, I get what they're doing, and they're having fun, but I'm not participating in it. I'm not invited into the party.
I could see that, but I, like, it was definitely, I wanted people to be invited to the party.
Yeah.
It was always like something like Teddy Bomb, which is definitely like Sam Raimi-ish and crazy. I think the best description is someone recently sent me a review which said, like, this is the film, this is like as if Scott Pilgrim, the comic book character, made a movie based on Scott Pilgrim. Which is like, so it's kind of like scruffy, and it's like energetic, and it's just everything that I love up on screen. And like, I can, like, people going like, okay, well, this wasn't made with a lot of money, so why should I like be watching it, I guess. And that's like the weird, like, the thing where it's like, I always argue with people about this, which is like, would you rather see something energetic and like everyone's dedicated, and it costs nothing, and you can see it costs nothing? Or would you rather have something like middling and slick?
Yeah.
And it's usually middling and slick.
People do settle for middling and slick. My thing is that if you're going to make a movie with nothing, the ideas behind it have to be strong enough to compensate.
Yeah.
And Teddy Bomb is a very simple comic premise, and it's not a bad one, but it's just like there's really nowhere to go.
Well,
but repeat the same variation on the
I mean, over again. The one thing I tell people about Teddy Bomb is that, like, if watch it again, it's really about like not standing up for yourself, but like the idea that like no one can do things for you except for yourself, and that's what the movie's about. Like, that's the idea that I approached it with. And I mean, like, if you didn't get it or other people, like, obviously that wasn't communicated well enough. But it's interesting that now when people watch it, they're like, oh, I guess that was the idea of the movie, because it's more, like, conscious in the world right now.
Right. So that's, yeah, that's it too. Like, the cultural moment has to be there.
Yeah, of that idea of, like, what does it mean to, like, be, like, a white guy? Like, can you be heroic and it's wish fulfillment? Like, that's not what the movie is. It's actually, like, against that. But at the same time, the issue with something like Teddy Bomb is something that my friend Will Sloan once said, which we were watching a movie and I was like, oh, there's this great scene where a head exploded, and he's like, yeah, I can see gore anywhere. Like, it depends on like where, like what you want and how you're feeling, like that, like in your face stuff. Sometimes you just don't want it. Like, I go through years where I'm like, I don't want to watch movies like Teddy Bomb. Like, it's fine.
Right.
But sorry, getting back to...
No, it's all part of it.
Teddy Bomb. Yeah, that was definitely like Evil Dead. Because it was like, or Edgar Wright, or stuff like that, which is like, look at me! Like, I'm just doing all this crazy stuff. And, I mean, after that, I kind of wanted to take a step back and be like, well, I don't want to, like, always have to do this. Like, I was really hurt when, I remember I was in college, and somebody else told me they were in a group, and they were like, let's not do it like Justin Theclue does. And I was like, ugh. And I, like, I mean, that's not technically hurtful.
Well,
like,
unless you're Justin Theclue.
Unless I'm just, well, I mean, like, just that style, I guess, they don't like it. And it's just coming to terms with, like, well, that's what I like, and that's what, because I want to share with the audience, so either accept that or I don't. And I feel like that's the same thing that, like, Sam Raimi struggled with his entire career, which is like, I want to do this thing, but like, people can just write like, oh, I know what Sam Raimi is, and then you're like, oh no, like, Simple Plan, look.
Yeah.
And I mean, Impossible Horror, which is my new feature film, I went in consciously being like, well, I don't want to do like Teddy Bomb. Like, I want it to be completely different. And I succeed for like 20 minutes.
And then what? You just fall back
into it? Yeah, I fall back into it. Because I reached a point where I was making this movie and I went like, what am I enjoying? Like, why am I making this movie? Am I just trying to prove that I can do something different? Or do I want to do the things that I like and I hope the audience will like as well? And considering the movie is technically kind of about that, it's interesting to watch the movie and see that style evolve as it goes on, where it's like very slow with sliders and then suddenly gets handheld and like crazy like Sam Raimi would do it.
That's what I want.
Yeah, I know.
That's I want you to enjoy yourself. I want you to do the thing you want.
I know. And I want people to enjoy themselves as well. I don't want them to be like, ugh. Because again, like Impossible Horror is a movie that was made was it was made for $7,000. Like all in the money we raised in our Kickstarter. Uh-huh. And like you look at the movie and you're like, I believe it was made for $30,000, but not much more than that. So like I that's a lesson that I learned like as I make shorts and I do stuff, which is, you know, I should just follow what I'm passionate about.
We should tell people where they can find it. So it's actually screening at the Royal.
Yeah, it's screening at the Royal Cinema in Toronto on October 23rd at 7:30. That is also serving as like a Blu-ray release party. So you can get it on Blu-ray. And because I'm a movie fan, it has like a ridiculous amount of commentary tracks. It has a really fun making of that my partner Emily Milling cut together, deleted scenes, all that jazz. And if you come to the screening, like I did with Teddy Bomb, I call them South Korean special editions, because I don't know if you remember in the early 2000s when DVD was starting, they would be these ridiculous special editions from South Korea.
I think I still have the Dogville one, yeah.
Yeah, and they'd come in boxes and stuff like that. So I'll be making boxes, and that I'll be selling at the screening of Impossible Horror. And I think, unless... I may have a few that I'll sell at other screenings I do, but like you can only get it there. Like I won't sell on the internet or anything like that. But if you're listening to this and you don't live in Toronto, you'll be able to, you can pre-order it on the internet now, and it's $20 for the Blu-ray, and you'll get a poster and a code to listen to Emily Milling's score, which is really good, better than the movie. And so you should definitely check those things out.
Cool. All right. I'm going to go do that right now. Seriously.
Yeah.
Or I'll buy it at the night. I'll be there.
Oh, well, I very much appreciate that. And hopefully you won't feel like you're outside of the party. We'll be like, Norm, come in.
Yes, no, that's what I want. I want the VIP experience. Yeah. If I'm coming out.
Yeah, you expect the VIP experience.
The long walk from here to the Royal.
Yeah. Block and a
half. My thanks to Justin Declue, whose new film Impossible Horror comes to Blu-ray next Tuesday, October 23rd. You should really try to go to that screening at the Royal, but if you can't, the disc is available for pre-order right now at ImpossibleHorror.com. You can find Justin on Twitter at DeclueJ, DeclouXJ, all one word, and you should subscribe to the Important Cinema Club, No Such Thing as a Bad Movie, and Loose Cannons wherever you subscribe to podcasts. Yes, I know Loose Cannons isn't releasing new episodes just now, but I live in hope that we someday get that episode about Life Force, because, come on. You can find Army of Darkness on Blu-ray and DVD in a dozen different editions from Anchor Bay and Universal Studios Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.